cause it's alright. Good morning and welcome. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. It's 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning. That means it's books, writing and literary culture on Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel. Every week it is my absolute pleasure to host you for half an hour discussing the latest, the greatest, the classic Australian books. Now, if you've noticed, it's the 28th of October. For regular Final Draft listeners, you will know the last Saturday of the month is our Australian Classics Book Club. Now, before I get to the fantastic book, I want to introduce my guests. I'm joined by Jane Pearson from Text Publishing. Text are the wonderful people that produce the Text Classics from which we draw our Australian Classics Book Club. I've also got Kate Constable. She is an author of books for younger readers. That includes the Patricia Wrightson Award-winning Crow Country. Now, that is quite fortuitous because today on the show, we are actually discussing Patricia Wrightson's I Own the Racecourse. Patricia Wrightson is a fantastic, absolutely brilliant writer of children's literature in Australia. She's so important to Australian writing. And I Own the Racecourse is a wonderful, whimsical, fantastical, just lovely story of life growing up in Sydney in the 60s. I'm really excited to be discussing this. I'm really excited to have Jane and Kate on the show. Now, before we get to the book, I wanted to mention, you might be thinking, what am I going to do with the rest of my day, you know, when Final Draft is over? Check out Boundless Festival. It is a celebration of diverse writers that's happening in Bankstown today. It includes such writers as Michael Muhammad Ahmed, Sarah Ayoub, Julie Coe, Benjamin Law, we've got Ellen Van Nierven, Marcus Zusak. These writers are going to be coming together and exploring Australian writing and the diversity of voices that we have on offer. This is a fantastic opportunity to meet some of the people, to listen to them, to hear them discuss what is happening in Australian writing right now and what is going on into the future. I would really encourage you. You can find links on our Twitter and it's free. You just need to register. So it's Boundless Festival. It is happening down in Bankstown today. But I've got other things to talk to you about. I've got I Own the Racecourse by Patricia Wrightson. And we're going to be coming back with the Australian Classics Book Club after this short break.
From an evening of comedy to late and loose nights in Gonzo's Soul Club, good times await all week at Wayward's above the bank in Newtown. Every week, catch amazing artists from Newtown and beyond. Check out our full lineup of bands, comedy, DJs and plenty more at bankhotel.com.au. The Bank Hotel, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft and my name is Andrew Popel. And it is that time of the month again where we revisit an Australian classic from the Text Classics range. It's Australian Classics Book Club. I am joined by text editor Jane Pearson. Jane, welcome.
Hi, Andrew.
And I'm also joined by author Kate Constable, who has written the introduction for this text classic that I will reveal in just a second. Kate, welcome to the book club.
Thank you for having me.
Now, today we have the absolutely wonderful I Own the Racecourse by Patricia Wrightson. She is a star in Australian children's writing, and this is such a wonderful book. I had such a great time this week reading it, and I'm loving the idea of sharing it. Before we get to the book, though, I'd like to know a little bit more about Patricia Wrightson. Jane, can you tell us about who Patricia Wrightson was and her writing and its influence in Australia?
Patricia Wrightson was writing for kids at a time when Australian children didn't have a lot of access to stories about themselves. And she was part of a group of writers that really changed that, started writing about Australian kids in Australia, and sort of spearheaded the wonderful publishing scene we have today for children and young adults. She's really kind of, I don't know, the doyen, the queen, or rightly revered for her place in our canon. She was born in Lismore in 1921, spent a lot of her life there, but she also lived for quite a period of time in Sydney in the 60s and 70s, I believe, and for a time there she was the assistant editor of New South Wales School magazine. So she was really kind of connected to kids and to Sydney and to the setting for this book, I Own the Racecourse, because it's set in a... she gives the suburb a fictional name, and I guess it could be any number of places, but it's in a Western Sydney, and you really kind of feel that, I don't know, grit and realism of the of that time and that place. She wrote 27 books, I believe. Four of them were CBCA winners, Children's Book Council of Australia winners. That's a real accolade. But it doesn't end there. She received an OBE for her services to children's literature. She and a Dromkeen Medal, the Hans Christian Andersen Award. She also won, and that's an international award that's only been won by a very small number of Australian writers. In fact, maybe only two. Oh, she was also the New South Wales Premier's Award for children's writing is named in her honour. So that really gives a sense, I think, of just how loved and how important she is in Australian children's literature. These days, we might look at some of her work in a different light from how it was intended or received at the time. She drew on Aboriginal stories and incorporated those into many of her stories. The Nagan and the Stars is one of her most loved books, and then there was the Wirin trilogy as well, among many others. And I think what she was seeking to do was to bridge the sort of cultural divide. She died at the age of 88, not all that long ago, in 2010, and, you know, left us with this wonderful, wonderful legacy that includes this really special and beautiful book, I Own the Racecourse.
And if you're not familiar with I Own the Racecourse, I mean, I have to admit, this was my first reading of I Own the Racecourse. A quick glance through Patricia Wrightson's back catalogue of books, you quickly realise you've come across these books when you're at school. There are so many there that I think so many of us have experienced. And it was really wonderful to discover I Own the Racecourse. It's set, as you mentioned, Jane, in a fictional suburb of Sydney, which I live in Sydney's inner west, and it sort of looked a little bit like around Wentworth Park, Glebe, sort of Glebe Foreshore, maybe Forest Lodge, I'm not sure. It was nice for me to place it in a cityscape. And a set of friends, our main character is Andy Hoddle, who is, at the beginning of the book, I guess you would say duped into handing over $3 to buy the race course. But Andy's force of belief leads the entire suburb to be captured in this fantasy of him owning the race course. And we have this wonderful, I guess, evocation of the innocence of Andy's vision and how it can actually impact on a whole suburb. I think we're going to get into the details a little bit more, but that in a nutshell is I Own the Racecourse. It is about a young boy buying a racecourse and running it. And it occurred to me as I was reading the novel and prepared for our discussion, the three of us, Kate, Jane, we're probably not particularly the readership Patricia Wrightson had in mind when she was writing I Own the Racecourse. Of course, I'm not going to tell anyone what to read, and if sales figures for young adult fiction are anything to go by, wouldn't matter if I did. But I thought maybe we start by talking a little bit about how Patricia Wrightson's young readership might have received the novel. This was being read in the late 60s, I think it was published in 68, so late 60s, early 70s, and then many, many younger readers would have experienced in the 80s. How would a young reader have read this, do you feel?
Well, I do think that this is, even though it is such a realist story and there is no supernatural element to it at all, I do think it's a story about magic. And I think that Andy creates this magic within his own head, that he sees the racecourse as a magical land, really. When he's looking, he finds a little spot on the cliffs where he can look down at it at night and see it all lit up and the horses and the silks. And Wrightson does such a fantastic job of painting this this wonderland, and the thought that he owns this place, as he comes to believe, is such a big dream for him. And I think as readers we're kind of pulled along with him too, that it's a story about magic, and this magic is so big and so all-encompassing that it ends up not just capturing Andy, but it captures all his friends, it captures the workers at the track, it captures everyone in the suburb, as you said, Andrew. And I think that's how perhaps a young reader might approach it initially, as a magic story, a story of some a fabulous dream that comes true.
I tried to put myself in a younger mindset, and being young, I mean, it's never specifically mentioned what age Andy is, but I'm imagining him around somewhere between maybe 9 or 13 years old, and you're beset with tragedy at that age, especially in your fantastic world where inevitably supernatural ideas that you've been led to believe, you know, maybe Santa Claus, maybe other types of things, are revealed as not being exactly what you thought they were. And this is actually a fantastical story that you don't have to let go of. Andy holds onto it. And I feel like a younger version of me might think, well, this is something that can't be taken away, because ultimately, you pointed out there, Kate, everyone has to come to acknowledge Andy's reality of this.
I think you summed it up beautifully with that line, and his dream came true, because I think what Patricia Wrightson's doing so beautifully in this novel is looking at what is true and what is real and how we decide. And Andy's, you know, possible fantasy of owning this race course, and it does come from, you know, it does come through from a very logical place. He and his friends are playing, or he's just on the outer of a game that they play where they pretend that they own things, and he tries to play, and he kind of gets it a bit wrong a few times, and then when he meets this old tramp who says, yeah, I'll sell you my race course, it's a packet of trouble anyway, for $3, which, so he buys this sort of, you know, as a natural progression of their game, but because of this financial transaction, it's given a grounding in reality, and that sort of gives him the basis to start expanding what that means in his imagination, and looking down at this wonderful place from up on the cliff and all the light and colour and excitement of it, and it just it becomes his world. And we are welcomed, you know, the reader, the child reader, the adult reader is welcomed to step into that world where reality isn't necessarily grounded in the normal way the economy works.
As an adult, I felt really protective for Andy at the beginning of the book, especially when he's sort of described as an old tramp. He just seems like someone who's spending way too much time in the pub. And when Andy gives him the money, he sells Andy the race course. He's clearly drunk, has no idea what's going on except that someone's giving him money. And I was just like, this can only end badly for Andy.
I had the same feeling. But, you know, at the same time, Patricia Wrightson doesn't let us write him off as an old con man. You know, he says...
I did. Sorry. And this is probably a good spot to take a track before we come back and we get much deeper into the story of I Own the Racecourse and discover Andy and his friends. I am joined by Kate Constable and Jane Pearson. You are listening to Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. And because we're exploring a book that takes us back to Sydney's Inner West... When I think Inner West, and I'm pretty sure this book is set somewhere in Glebe, I think of bands like UMI. So I wanted to share a bit of an older track from UMI and its Purple Sneakers. I'm Andrew Purple, and you're on 2SER 107.3.
Had a scratch only you could itch underneath the Glebe Point Bridge. And now every boy in a knitted vest has got some precedent. So I took a personality pill and something red to swill. And now every fire has gone out, and every heart that wanted to kill, let's call it a day. We'll be right back.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. And that track right there was Purple Sneakers from UMI, taking us back to the 90s. Bit of a classic track there. Now, you are in the Australian Classics Book Club. I'm Andrew Popel, and talking classic tracks, we've got a classic book. We are talking about Patricia Wrightson's I Own the Racecourse. Now, I am joined by Jane Pearson from Text Publishing and Kate Constable. She is an author and wrote the introduction to I Own the Racecourse. And we've been exploring the story of Andy Hoddle and how his wonderful imagination and just force of will convinces an entire suburb that he owns the racecourse, Beecham Park, in a suburb that I suspect is somewhere around Glebe. It feels very much like Wentworth Park. And Andy is joined by an amazing crew of friends. I felt like in some way, Joe and Andy's other friends stand in our stead as readers, and they're vacillating between this desire to believe and this nagging impossibility of it all. And I thought there was this powerful magic to the psychology of I Own the Racecourse. The book, for me, it operated almost like a utopian fantasy of suburban life, where you have a character that you put yourself in the shoes of, who is living in this world that's a little bit outside your experience. Andy bends reality around his belief in the ownership. I wondered a little bit if the collective agreement of this fantasy was not just simply a generosity on the part of the locals, because it's not just his friends that come to believe. People in the street say, oh, ho, look, it's the owner. How are you going today? Are you going to inspect? And I feel like they want to believe it too, because acknowledging a world in which Andy owns the racecourse is actually a better world than the world where it's a capitalist endeavor run for profit.
That's so true. But I think, and I think you're so right, that we are in the place of his friends as readers, that we're wanting to protect him as well. And I think as a reader, you're always kind of holding your breath thinking, oh, it's all going to come crashing down. When is it going to be? And every new kind of escapade of Andy's brings you just that little bit closer to the brink, and you're just almost shuddering thinking, oh, this is going to be it. This is when it's all going to fall apart.
But isn't it lovely that amongst his friends they have slightly different views on how to deal with this and what they should be doing? So I think it's really interesting that Patricia Wrightson doesn't really tell us which of those two boys has got it right. They're both caring for their friends.
They're both right. And yeah. I think they're both right because they're both coming from a position of care, and you know they want what's best for Andy ultimately, and everyone really wants that. There's no maliciousness in the book at all. Well, just, you know, maybe some of the older boys are a little bit mean, but you know everybody really wants to protect Andy and to, you know, to see him come out unhurt. So,
but she does give us those little hints of a darker possibility lurking around the edges, so we're not completely able to say, oh, this is harmless and we should all just join him. Or just as you might start thinking that, there's a little hint of something in the shadows that could really seriously bring some harm to Andy.
I wondered, and this is partly the reason why I wanted to start by acknowledging that I'm definitely not the readership necessarily, because I'm going to put thoughts and ideas onto this story that may not be there. But I wondered if Patricia Wrightson was perhaps actually looking at some competing worldviews, and there may be some subtle hints or commentary on the world as she saw it. Because ownership of the racecourse, to me, it seemed to come down to two competing worldviews. We have this sort of egalitarian communal view that Andy embodies, and he brings people to his idea, and people support him behind it. And then you have this capitalist view that's evinced by the well-dressed men in their expensive seats. And the juxtaposition of these, for me, it came to a head in the scene that draws through, where Andy decorates the old rundown stand at Beecham Park for Joe's birthday, and you have Andy, and he's defended in this endeavour by everyone, and they come to his defence and they say it does no one harm, and they repeatedly justifying it. The committee, however, are concerned for the look of it and how that may impact their attendance and their profits. It's probably not what was foremost in the minds of young readers, but the impact of the way that discussion plays out, I thought, would, and perhaps this was Wrightson's intention, be a really powerful one to impact how those young minds sort of start to view their world. The capitalist committee, they're always faceless. We don't really meet them. The closest we come is their $10. They're faceless and selfish, whereas Andy's actions, they're only ever for others, and he's got this popular support that's his groundswell. She never tells us, Patricia Wrightson never tells us what's right. She lets us keep an open mind along with Joe and Terry and Mike and Matt, but she definitely, I think steers us in a particular direction.
Well, I think she's reminding us that even the most wonderful imagination and the most wonderful way of viewing the world is always going to come up against that kind of thing. It can't exist. You can't create the entire world in this beautiful way that would be wonderful. There's just always going to be...
I don't know. I think the opposite, Jane. Yeah. I think it's saying even though the world is a harsh and cruel place run by faceless men, you can still create, a wonderful belief in it.
Yeah.
How, we all own the world. We all own the race course, really. And it's up to us to shape the world that we live in, and our own beliefs can do that. I think...
Oh, that's a much better reading. I like that. Yeah.
I think we see arguments like this continually playing out. What we see in I Own the Racecourse, this idea of the community getting behind something versus the motivation of profit. Mm. I see a similar thing in Sydney. So, are you familiar with the whole discussion that's going on around the Sirius block of towers down at the quay, and this beautiful old brutalist block of towers that was built for public housing, and the backers are trying to get it heritage listed. The government want to tear it down and put up, high-rise, expensive apartments. And so you've got this community trying to come together for the vision of something that is nostalgic, something that is aesthetic. Mm. And then you've got this motivation of profit. And, I mean, the only thing that's missing from the Sirius is Andy basically telling everyone that he owns it, and so they can't tear it down. Mm. I love that element of the story, and I love more so that it's so deftly handled that a young reader can experience it and not feel like they're being beaten with any sort of philosophical cane, but rather that they just come to
it. It's funny, actually, because I hadn't really thought of this dimension of the story until you started bringing it up, but now I'm thinking about it, it's really a very political, subversive novel.
Mm. And we really do all think like Andy, because when something happens in, outside our own maybe properly owned property, we do feel a sense of ownership. If your local park is affected by something or any sort of development comes along, whether you like it or not, you feel like, no, this is my world that it's in, and I should have a say, and I have a stake in all of this. So we're all Andy, I guess.
Yeah, wow, I really did not expect this discussion to go in this direction, but it's true.
it's a very unique perspective that Andy brings to this issue of ownership. And we were talking off mic before we began the book club discussion about Patricia Wrightson's representation of Andy. And it begins where he's described as living behind glass, and at some point in his childhood, Wrightson describes a window began closing on him, separating him from his friends. Now, Kate, in your introduction, you discuss how diagnostic terms like intellectual disability weren't commonly in use in the 60s and 70s when this was being first read. And in fact, much crueler terms and the stigma that followed might have attached itself to someone like Andy. Now, we decided we didn't want to beat the book over the head with this side of the narrative, but I think it's worth looking at it because it really informs Andy's point of view. What do you think Wrightson's representation of Andy might mean for our broader understanding of the story, but also Andy as a character?
Well, I think it's very interesting that Patricia Wrightson doesn't ever put a label on him. She talks about Andy as a person, and he's not just his disability. He is a person who sees the world in a particular way, and we as readers are left to kind of draw our own conclusions about what exactly that means. But, everyone knows that Andy's different. Andy knows himself, or he guesses that he's different, but he doesn't put a label on himself either. And it was interesting when I was asked to write the introduction to the book, and I had never read it, I didn't know anything about the story. And then it just rang so true for me because my own sister has an intellectual disability too, and I could see so much of her in Andy, that real eagerness to belong and that real vulnerability and that real stubbornness as well that I think is present with a lot of people who see the world in a slightly different way. And to me, Andy is so real and so rounded as a character.
It strikes me that writing a character like Andy, centering him in the narrative and acknowledging this undiagnosed situation that we have, Patricia Wrightson's actually done a huge thing in terms of disability and visibility. Whatever is happening with Andy in terms of his neurodiversity, it's not central to the narrative. Mm. It's acknowledged, but it doesn't drive the narrative. And so Patricia Wrightson's done something really powerful in terms of representation now. It's maybe a voice that she can only ever approximate, but I think it's quite a powerful voice for that reason.
It's also, I think, really lovely in the way she presents how his friends respond to him. I mean, there's the obvious need to protect him when they're fearing for him, but this lovely way that she describes their friendship and how as it became apparent that he was a bit different, the friendship that had been established when they were really, really little just carried on, and they just accommodate him as he is, without going to that kind of possibly patronising place of, you know, we'll make sure we include him. He's part of their gang for exactly who he is, and he can't, you know, and he's often walking along behind them or on the fringes, and everybody just sort of is cool and natural with that. That's what I love. There was no sense of showing us how friends should behave when there's a person who's a little bit different. It just naturally was this lovely kind of friendship that ebbed and flowed a little bit and just felt like any group of kids. It's lovely.
There's a moment, it's at the end of the book. It's not particularly giving away anything of the ending, but it's Mike. So the group are discussing Andy, and they're doing it in a way that I guess probably as adults we could see is a little bit infantilizing. They're discussing him without him being there. But Mike sort of jumps in and jumps to the defense, and they're arguing about whether he should, you know, they should help him build a model plane. And Terry says he'll only bust it. Mm-hmm. And Mike just jumps in and he says, what does it matter? He's got to have things sometimes, even if he does bust them. And it's just basically, he's not a toy or something to be protected. He has agency. He has a right to live his life. And that scene, like that almost, that had me almost at tears because I was just like, that's a brilliant takeaway.
Yeah, I think that is the heart of the whole book for me. That was the line that really summed it all up.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3 and you've been listening to the Australian Classics Book Club. It is time for me to go. Thank you so much again to Kate Constable and Jane Pearson for joining me in the Australian Classics Book Club. Stay tuned for more 2SER, The Vulture's Nest. Do check out Boundless Festival, a festival of diverse writers happening in Bankstown today. If you're looking for something to do or you just want more amazing writing, my name's Andrew Popel. I'm back next week with more Final Draft. I'll see you then. Bye for now.